Good morning, everyone. And as I said earlier, for any of you who weren't on then, that this is both our Sunday meditation and Dharma talk, as well as it is the third and final day of our three-day retreat here. I'm saying in Tampa, but it's there are some people who've been live with me and during retreat in the meditation hall, but most people have been in Zoom land. So anyway, we have been on a three-day retreat, and this is the final meditation and talk of this retreat. So I'm sort of bringing our Sunday gathering with the retreatants. So this was a different kind of retreat. We have been holding retreats in our community for years and years. And usually our retreats are on a very, like our intensives and other things, on a very specific aspect of the Buddhist practice, specific teachings, texts. And they usually have a focus in, practices related to the mindful living path or the Dharma path or the wisdom path, as well as we, do intensives in a similar way. But what has been interesting me and for several years is there seems to be two things that go on. One is the practice, learning the practice, practicing the practice, which is fairly straight ahead. And then there is all the other things that go on around people practicing, all the things that they have to deal with or get in the way of. And so months ago, I asked many of our senior members who have been doing retreats and intensives, but mostly who've been doing mentoring groups, individually mentoring people, group mentoring and intensives, asking them, I don't want to hear about the practice. I want to hear about all the things that people talk about that are getting in the way of their practice, you know. And so I asked them to send that in, and they sent me quite a list. Let me just quickly read through it. Self-judgment, self-criticism, self-doubt, sense of unworthiness, impatient, expecting immediate results, lack of trust in the process, wanting things to be different than they are, old wounds, memories, anxieties, anger, dramatizing issues in lives, particularly in relationship, distraction, dispersion, lack of concentration, intellectualizing, conceptualizing, overthinking, difficulty staying in the present moment, wanting to be in control, do things my way, difficulty being with uncertainty, uncomfortable not knowing. So that's a partial list. So it struck me, of course, that this is the elephant in the living room. That we are dealing with in people's questions, but we never focus on it. You know, it's sort of like there are these two tracks. One is our track of study and practice, and then is this other track of really what's going on with people and all the things that are coming up that are getting in the way of their ability to really study and practice and put it into their lives. So for a while I've thought, I want to do a retreat on this and not a retreat on the Buddhist teachings and practice. So we finally did it. It was a good beginning. And we called it Getting Unstuck, Meeting the Challenges of Practice. And just to get people going, about 4 or 5 days before retreat, everybody who was coming, I think we had close to 60 people, sent them an email asking them to reflect. What factors get in the way of your practice and impede your progress on your path? What trips you up, thwarts you, prevents you from making the changes in your life that you want? And of course, we got a lot of replies to that. So So this was the real focus of the retreat. In other words, you know, where are people stuck? And again, that's a long list, but you know, where are they stuck? And you know, there's a name for this in Buddhism. For those of you familiar with the Buddhist teachings, you know, they're called hindrances. And traditionally there are 5 hindrances, 10 fetters, you know, there are different categorization. But you know, these obstacles that get in the way of both our meditative practice, our ability to settle down and concentrate, but even more importantly, our inability to practice the teachings, even though they make sense to us and we know they'd be beneficial, these are the things that hinder us. And traditionally in Buddhism, there are things like, desire, which traditionally was sensual desire, but it really is that mind that's always wanting, needing, desiring, and not just for sensual pleasure. It is the mind of ill will. Sort of desire leads to attachment, ill will leads, you know, aversion leads to, and ill will leads to avoidance. Restlessness, sloth, torpor, and doubt. So these are the traditional 5 hindrances. And one of the things I said to people on retreat, these never grabbed me. I mean, I understood them, but they never grabbed me. They only grabbed me when I interpreted them for myself, how they manifested in my life, and I gave them names that related to actual experiences of very specifically how these things were arising in me. And again, in the same way that that list of probably 20 different hindrances that I read to you earlier that I'm sure many of you could relate to, you know, this is the way they come up to us. But our problem historically is we deal with them situation by situation, you know, specific little hindrance by specific hindrance. So we have this long laundry list of hindrances that we are always dealing with. And it struck me that people are dealing with these things for years and years. And while they get some remediation, some softening, some lessening of intensity, they're still very present in people's lives. The hindrances are still there. So, you know, how can we, you know, do a direct frontal look at these hindrances and really help people get free? So the other difference about this retreat was rather than a lot of teaching, there was really the posing of a lot of questions. And what I base this on was something that I've come to realize over time is a significant hole in Americans in our practice of Buddhism. And again, what I'm going to say now, probably most of you have been around and have heard me say this many times, but this, give me a moment. The Buddha said, hear my teachings, contemplate my teachings, practice my teachings. This was his presentation. You know, first, intellectually, we encounter the teaching. In his day, they heard them. There weren't books. In our days, we hear that, we read, we listen to, you know, and we can do it ad nauseum because now through the internet, we can access, you know, endless, you know, through endless books and endless podcasts and talks, YouTube, we can be listening to the Dharma. And then traditionally, with sort of just a small intellectual understanding, we decide we want to what? We're going to practice. We're going to meditate, or we're going to do these practices. And we often do not get very good results. of any consistency or depth. Why not? And what I've come to realize is we do not spend real in-depth time contemplating. I don't think we even know what that means. I think, you know, our minds kind of, because we are so distractible, because we have such short-term intention, because we traditionally are spoon-fed, this willingness to encounter a teaching and really reflect deeply on it, really chew on it, which is really a process of questions. Because when we turn a statement into a question, then it implies that we're going to have to go deeper to come up with a real answer, not just something facile. That's what reflection. Reflection is not thinking about. Many of us, you know, we know how to endlessly think about something, which is a very superficial kind of way. Reflection is really chewing on something, kind of getting it into one's maw, you know, and really, what does this really mean? What are the real implications? What's, you know, what's really going on if I really took this in? So what this retreat involved a lot was giving some talk, giving people questions, and then giving them time to reflect and write down what came up to them, and then processing it with them. So just to give you some example for those who weren't at retreat, questions like, what is it that I want to change in my life? Stop. Deeply reflect. Not a facile, quick answer. What is getting in the way of my peace of mind, internal happiness, loving heart? And then after answering that question deeply, you know, really meditating on it, do I really want to change? And the emphasis is on really. You know, we endlessly say, oh, I want to change this, I want to change that, but do I really want to change? Really want to change enough that I'm really going to want to do something about it? Can I see the change, the implications? If I do change, transform my life. At some point I asked people, after they had kind of categorized their afflictive hindrances, I said to them, can you really imagine what your life would be like if these were not present in your mind at all? Can you even imagine being free of them? What that would feel like? What kind of energy would be freed up inside you? Who, what do I trust? The historical voice in my head, my historical desires or needs, or my voice of aspiration, the Dharma, the teacher, the three jewels? What do I really take refuge in? Who do I really trust? Another series of questions were, do I reflect deeply and consistently about my hindrances and the costs of my maintaining them? Stop. That was an exercise. Just stop. Do I really know my hindrances? Do I name them? Can I see how they arise in my mind, in my life, you know, maybe throughout my life? Do I know them? Can I name them? And do I call them hindrances, or do I just call that me? Do I see them as dysfunctional, maladaptive, and the saboteur of my desire to lead a wholesome, happy life? So the process of reflection creates ownership. I think one of the problems when we walk a path like the Dharma, like the Buddhist path, that has been taught for 2,600 years, lots of experience. And there's so many books out, so many blah, 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 Dharma, that we know it, but we don't own it. And what I try to help people do in this retreat is take ownership of their transformation, take ownership of their change, take ownership of what arises in the mind, take ownership of their hindrances, of their afflictions. Name them. Ask them, do you really see them as hindrances? Not because they're listed somewhere or because Fred said so. Do you really see so? I ask people to look at their minds. You know, if they look at their minds throughout the day, what percentage of their thoughts are wholesome, what percentage are unwholesome, and what percentage are meaningless? You know, really look, you know, where is my mind all day? What am I cultivating all day? What am I thinking about all day? You know, we may say we're practicing the Dharma, but perhaps we're really just practicing a worldly life or affliction. Another reflection. Can I stop and place each of my hindrances before me and look at them, evaluate, assess them, and make a conscious decision about whether I want to maintain them or not? Do I know my stuff? Do I know my garbage and label it such? Although I may recognize the wholesome and dysfunctional in me, do I really have a sense of what wholesome really looks like? Do I have a felt sense of that? Dharma and Dharma practices, including mindfulness and meditation, are a concrete strategy for change. I talked about the Eightfold Path, the Six Paramitas. I talked about the Buddha's strategy for change. And then I challenged everybody in the retreat, do you have a very clear strategy about your own change and transformation? And most people said, gee, I never thought about that. So I gave them an assignment of, you know, really reflecting deeply and developing their own personal strategy based on their aspirations, based on their commitments, based on knowing very specifically what their hindrances are that are getting in the way. You know, what is your strategy for change? Do you have one? Are you committed to working it? Are you aware of it every day? Are you working your strategy? Not the Buddhist strategy, not Fred's strategy, but have you made it your own strategy because you really want to change? So it was an interesting retreat. Again, and I think, before I say more, what I'd like to do, I've asked a few people, again, retreat only really ended, probably we ended at around 9 o'clock with closing circle and then had a break for breakfast and then here we are. So I've asked three people who were just on the retreat, if they would just share what it was like to be on this retreat, what was their experience, just to give people who didn't give on retreat a sense of what this kind of retreat is like and what it was like for them. First, let me ask Tammy. Two of the people are in the hall. Let me ask Tammy, who is in Marco, and she's online. Tammy, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. So.
Okay.
Maybe, 3 to 5 minutes to share your experience.
Okay. This is Tammy Balling in. Great to be with you all this morning. For me, this was a powerfully transformative retreat. And I'm not just saying that because, there's sort of that retreat bliss or the retreat afterglow, when you feel really great. for a couple of days, then you go back into the real world and all your stuff just comes back up again and it's not so great. This retreat really was different. And I think for me, you know, I've been on lots of retreats. I've been practicing under Fred for about 7 years, and I probably have been probably on 10 to 12 retreats, not counting like Dharma transmission retreats or anything like that. And what was different about this retreat is just, I feel like it met me where I'm at on the path. So I think at 7 years, maybe I'm was having a little bit of the 7 year itch. Or maybe I'm just at a point in my path and in life, as I'm getting closer to 50, where I'm just, you know, re-evaluating, you know, what's true for me, what's authentic, you know, what is the path for me? What does that really look like? What do I want out of practice? What do these practices really mean for me? So these are the kinds of questions I was already beginning to ask, but largely in my time practicing under Fred, the reflection piece, I'm sheepish to admit, has been missing. I really, you know, I tend to in life cruise through things. And I expect out of my own causes and conditions to just get things like this. You know, Fred gives a teaching, snippety snap, I fall in line, I practice, I transform. And I really, that has produced a lot of suffering for me because it doesn't work like that. There is sort of the, what that sense of impatience, you know, Fred going through all of the, you know, the hindrances, but also the American style hindrances. And many of them I see in myself, and impatience is one. I expect myself to sort of snap to it and get it. And yet, you know, I really am in process. And Fred has said that to me many times, and I've had earmuffs over my years, not receiving that. And what I'm really understanding is that, yes, I am in process. That process is unfolding, you know, and everything's fine. Everything's really fine. So the reflection piece was really important. The meditative evaluation. So again, Fred's also often talked about, you know, don't just flop down on the cushion and expect something to happen. And sometimes I do that. And so we had this wonderful, you know, practical, experiential training, learning how to reflect and also to evaluate after meditation. And I'm a very practical kind of person, an experiential person. I don't consider myself, at least in the Dharma, a very scholarly person. And that really, you know, really fit me really well and really met me, you know, where I'm at. And then just the labeling, you know, to sit in meditation. And I feel like I understand better, why do we practice? I'm embarrassed to say, 7 years of practicing. Why do we practice, you know, shamatha or shine or calm abiding? Why do we practice that? What is the point of building meditative concentration? And I feel like I really was able to get that and practice that, to be able to see, you know, someone said in the closing circle, the landscape of mind, and to be able to label that and understand that, and to also, you're labeling it, or I'm labeling it, but there's nothing to fix. There's no more self-improvement. There's no fixing. There's just seeing, there's labeling, and it's, you know, really resting in that arising and passing. So there's so much more, you know, to say. You know, the strategy piece was really missing for me as well. It was just a really, really wonderful retreat. And I know I've gone over time, but I really bow to you, Fred. And I also bow to Diane and Betsy for just conceiving this retreat. And it was really, really, really powerful. Tammy bowing out.
Thank you, Tammy. And again, I didn't mean to limit you to whatever I said in time. I was just sort of giving parameters. I mean, if there is anything else you want to share, please feel free to, Tammy.
Well, I mean, I think the other thing too is just the asking of the questions. And for me, the questions, you know, you sort of like the first few years of practice, it's not like I was really in crisis, so to speak, but it sort of was a few stages under that. Now it's really, and I practiced because it was a life raft. So many things were happening in life, and I had no reference for how to work with that. So the first few years was just like, you know, that hang in there, kitty poster. And now I'm not in that space. Now I'm in that space of asking the question of, do I accept the low-grade suffering that is there? Do I even call things like impatience or annoyance or those things that arise in me? Do I even classify that as suffering? Do I really see the mind of dissatisfaction and how that produces suffering in my life and potentially for others? And do I want to change that? You know, do I see that the life of pleasure, you know, you ask this question of, am I really disillusioned with worldly pleasures? And the honest answer to that is mostly. There still is that poor little girl who sort of climbed up the caste system that thinks that, you know, she still thinks that if she gets this and that. But I think the good news is that I see more and more that there's really nothing in that. So I think just the asking of these questions and reflecting deeply and just trusting, you know, in the three jewels and trusting in the teacher, which I'm happy to say, you know, I really, really do. And trusting in myself and my own process. I have my own way, this being processes in her own way, and to trust in that and that it will all unfold if I just do what the heck the teacher is saying. So with that, I will bow out. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Tammy. Now, trying to get some variety here. So I've asked Max, who's a newer member, younger member, has not been on that many retreats with us, I don't know, just to share his experience.
Dear friends, this is Max Bangman.
Thank you, Max.
It was very much a retreat on surveying, like Tammy and the other member said during closing circle, the mind and what's really going on in there and how is my practice really, and what really are the things that are getting me stuck, and do I really realize that these are things that are getting me stuck, that they're not just part of me and part of life, that these are really hindrances. When we first started the retreat, we were asked to kind of reflect on, you know, what do you think is getting you stuck? Or what do you feel stuck on that's really preventing you from fulfilling your aspiration? And, you know, for me, I chose what seems to be my biggest hindrance, which is anxiety. But throughout the retreat, you know, as Fred and Diane and Betsy went through these kind of five hindrances from the Buddha and also these American hindrances that they formulated. You know, I could see a little bit of all of that in me. And particularly also the mind of dissatisfaction, I realize is much more prevalent than I thought it was. A mind of impatience. And To be honest, it was it was a pretty difficult retreat for me. It was, you know, as I kind of became more aware of these things in me, I could feel impatience with these things rising up. So, you know, impatience with impatience, or impatience with anxiety, or impatience with doubt, or sometimes even a problem with authority. I had actually asked a question to Fred during the retreat, and you know, he gave an answer, and after the answer, part of me kind of thought, well, he didn't really understand my question. So, and yeah, I realized that all of this is within me, and it is really hindering me from fulfilling my commitment, from fulfilling my vow to awaken and to really, really be of benefit to others. You know, all of this stuff is just putting up a wall between myself and others. And it's of no benefit to the world, and it's of no benefit to me. But what is of benefit is being able to see these things. Yeah, I think that was also something that, as the retreat went on, I became more, I don't know if conversant in is the right word, or just seeing that, learning to be patient with these things, not patient in a way of, you know, I'm tolerating them and I just want to continue to nurse them as, or be unconsciously nurse them as I have been doing. But be patient with them in terms of seeing, oh, okay, this is just arising because past Max, unconsciously, out of his own ignorance, was cultivating these things, and he didn't know any better. And that's why there's a, I don't know, this, that's why the field inside is just amok. It's kind of a bit of a mess. And now I'm here and I can understand that. So what's the next step? Okay, you know, it's that once I understand that, it becomes a, you know, less personal and just more simple. Okay, well then I gotta start cleaning up somewhere if I really want to turn this field into something beautiful that will really be of benefit to myself and others. Yeah, I think it feels in a lot of ways like still the beginning of a journey, even though the retreat has ended. I still feel like I have a lot of things that I need to reflect on more deeply and continuously reflect on. Fred and Diane and Betsy and the Sangha has really helped me understand that, you know, these old habitual patterns are something that I've gone over again and again and again and again in my mind. So, I mean, the only way to overturn that is to go over these, you know, my aspiration again and again, and really my weariness and my determination to fulfill my vow again and again and again. That's the only way that it can change. And I think the last thing is just understanding that my role, first and foremost in this life, everything else just comes and goes. You know, jobs, school, relationships, whatever. But, you know, I'm always, except at the very end, I guess I won't have my body, but I'll always have my body mind with me. And really my role is to tend to this body mind. And at the same time, it's a training to tend to this body mind. And I, like with any training, I need a lot of help. I need all the help that I can get from the teacher and the Sangha and my mentors and the Dharma and my friends and my family. And yeah, that I need to kind of let go. I felt like I was kind of in quicksand, and it's not as bad as it used to be. I used to be up to my head, and maybe now I'm more up to my chest or a little bit below my head. But I'm still like holding on to some of this quicksand, and these people are trying to help me. But I there's a part of me that's just not letting go and not letting them pull me out. So, I would definitely encourage anybody. I mean, this was a very unique retreat in that it was very personal, which I really appreciated. It really helped me, as I said, understand my own land better and really what I need to do. It can't be generic. It has to really sink into one's bones. And just the implications of the teachings on my life and how things really manifest in the reality of my life. It's really important to reflect on that, but I would just encourage anybody who has the opportunity to participate in these kind of retreats, because I feel like there is always that opportunity, no matter what kind of retreat it is, to really have this kind of clear looking at the body mind and just being able to connect with oneself in a non-judgmental and understanding way. And I'd also just encourage anybody to have an interview with Fred and really listen to him and talk to him and not be shy, and because he won't judge you, and it'll help you not to judge yourself and really live the life that you want to live. So that's all.
Well, it was definitely different that a person who likes to come at life with all the answers before even asking the questions was asked to totally reverse that. And I was very humbled in a very positive way by this. And it just started with, well, first of all, the joy of just sitting when you ask us just to sit and reflect and just write. I was like, God, this is amazing. And it was so different and so fresh and so deep. And as we went through the retreat, when you would say something, I would turn it into a question that I have to answer. Maybe not immediately, but soon. And at some point you said, the endless stories that cause you affliction. So I turned that into a question. Well, what are those stories that are causing that affliction all the time? And then what sabotages you? It's like, I never even thought about that. I know I'm sabotaged, but I never thought about, well, what specifically is sabotaging you? Put a name on it, right? Don't just let it come in, put a name on it. And this actually started in the mornings as you instructed us. I would see something come up, say, you don't need that. I saw it immediately, you don't need to think that. And just the gate went up. And that was really nice to go to bed at night and wake up with a sense of purpose. I thought I'd never say this, but I really like getting up at 5:15 and going straight until 9 o'clock at night, just doing one thing. It was a wonderful experience. But something that really struck me that you said early on, Fred, goes, and I wrote it down. You said, why do teachers teach and why have they been doing this for 2,600 years? And I never even thought about that. It's because they want us to be free. They want us to be liberated. They do it out of love and compassion. And it became ultimately clear to me that this is why we're here, is because people have suffered hardships. You know, I thought of Atisha. I thought of all the Tibetan masters who suffered so greatly just to bring this to us. And it really deeply moved me. It still moves me right now. But going back to the idea of sabotage, I wrote down, are you addicted to your thoughts? I never thought about that. What does that mean? How much of my life is meaningless thoughts? Because I think you asked later, the percentage of your thoughts are that are unwholesome, but I think you even said are meaningless. I thought, wow, a lot of my thoughts have no basis in reality. I'm just jabbering away, commenting on the world. Oh, bamboo, that must be, what variety is that? But what was good about being bell master, you were right there. So I wasn't like looking out the window too much, faking bathroom visits and all that. So it really kept me on point, which was good. Another thing about being bell master on a 3-day retreat, which I'd never done before, there was a minute of hesitation. And Fred just like, well, you know what to do. And if you don't, just ask. It's like, okay, I'm good with that. It's like, what great advice. You know what to do. And if you don't, just ask somebody. And so I hope it worked out. A lot of stuff came up. And these are things I will be reflecting on in my practice. How much of our historical conditioning is involved in our suffering? I need to really look at that. And why do we suffer? I think sometimes I know why I suffer. I just go back to the second noble truth, but that's not deep enough for me. There's something deeper, that's an intellectual understanding for me. And I did. I wrote the Eightfold Path and the Six Paramitas. I put a big star next to that because I know that's where I'm going with my practice. I'm very, very clear on that. And I mean, when I read it, I'm not just going to read it. I'm going to practice it. And when I know I'm off, I'm going to talk to somebody about it, Fred or a member of the Sangha. It's like, okay, you know, some I know I'm on point on right livelihood. I think I'm okay. But am I always in right view? Is that true generosity that I'm practicing? Or is that generosity for, you know, to look good? I don't know. I need to look at that. I really need to look at that. And then, do you want to be unhappy? A very simple question. Do I want to be unhappy? No, I don't. Then why are you? So let's look at that. And these are not questions I answered over the course of the retreat. But they're going to come up in my practice a lot. And I'm going to build that around the Noble Eightfold Path and the Six Paramitas as my frames of reference. Again, the simple stuff, what am I doing? What am I doing? Not just now, but why am I doing this practice? Self-discipline, 3 exclamation points. Better look at that one. And then this idea, when you eliminate the causes, the effects disappear because they have nothing to depend on. It's gone. I've never even thought about that. Well, that's really easy, right? Why didn't I think about that? I was very humbled by that, that I'm actually turning the way I look at, you know, and just stop being a teacher sometimes. And humble yourself and just be free and innocent and let the questions come in. And then, do I really want to change? 3 underlines. So that's a days of meditation, years of meditation. Or do I just say that? Do I really want to change, or do I just say that? Or can I just go through my life same old? It's comfortable. I'm not saying I haven't changed. I have changed. There's no doubt about that. But do I really want to be free? Or do I want to stay in minimum security prison or wherever I might be right now? I need to answer those questions. I've never truly, I mean, I might say, yeah, I want to be free. But what does that mean? What's the follow-up question to that? How do I go deeper on that? And do I want to be at ease? The answer is always yes, but what am I doing about that? And just more questions, and I'll just build over the coming, well, the rest of my life. How weary am I of samsara? I know I'm weary of it, but how weary? And what are you going to do about it? That the cyclic thinking patterns, addictive thinking patterns, thinking things are a certain way, not seeing reality as it is, it's just wearing me out. And I'm too old to be worn out. I don't know how much time I've got, so got to get on the stick. And actually, there's another, how much longer can you wait, right? I mean, I don't know. I live on Nebraska Avenue. I could walk across the street or walk down the street. It could be over. And I just said to, you know, really start to explore cause and effect. And this is very interesting. This never came up, but a writing teacher, I've always avoided teaching my students cause and effect essays. So there's something there. So what do you mean cause and effect? Oh, let's just do something else. But yeah, well, let's look at it. And so I really need to look at that. So those are just some of the notes. But the last one that really came out, and I shared this briefly this morning, is aspirations, commitments, and vows. And as I've shared, aspirations are, for me, I'm not saying they're not important, but for me, they're very light. Yeah, I want to be free. Then the commitment's a little deeper, and then a vow's like, I will do it regardless. And I'm not going to stop until, and I mean in a wholesome way. And so that's where that became very clear to me. I need to take very clear vows in my life. The aspirations are pure, I believe, but they're not strong enough for my habit energy. I have to, maybe I should be a monk, I don't know. Then I wouldn't be, you know, I wouldn't be of much use. I want to be here engaged in this part of our society. So I'm going to look very seriously at vows, and I will hold myself accountable to them. And when I slip, I'm not going to get down on myself, but I'm going to look at, okay, so what happened there? I do believe I have enough awareness. It's like, you made a vow, you slipped. How do I get back onto it? So that's, you know, again, this was a very different retreat for me. They're all great. And I think the transformations are to come. I can't say there was major transformations during the retreat, but I can see I have a very clear path of where I want to amp up my practice a little bit and where I want to take it. That's all I can think of right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy. You said it much better than I could have. And hopefully, you know, those of you who are not at retreat, or again, and for those of you who were at retreat, it's very inspiring to listen to our brothers and sisters share the fruits of their practice. I'm sure as these three people presented their insights, their understanding, their challenges, many of us saw ourselves, and we have learned. Just let me underline a few things that I heard people refer to. So one of the things that I did was, and this is not a definitive list, I tried to, I referred earlier to the traditional five Buddhist hindrances of desire, ill will, aversion, restlessness, torpor, and doubt. And what I said is, I think we Americans, and unfortunately it could be spreading around the world, you know, is we have our own special hindrances. And again, I think it's important that we speak in our own language, okay? It's not that the traditional hindrances aren't relevant, they certainly are, but, and again, you've heard me, I think one of the things that I've noticed that is pervasive is this mind of dissatisfaction, right? I mean, people, places, things, the temperature of our coffee, you know, you know, the world, I mean, it's not that there aren't things that need to be addressed. I'm talking about a pervasive mind of dissatisfaction that is actually searching unconsciously to find things to be dissatisfied about. And I think for people who this rings home, you will see your dissatisfaction can go from, you know, yourself, you know, what's going on in your home or your house or your relationships or the people in your life or your sangha, you know, right up to national politics, climate of the world. I mean, it is a pervasive way of looking at life and seeing it always, something's missing, something's wrong, something's not the way it should be. And I think we need to look at that. Another mind is this mind of worry. I think that is very particular to the American mind, and we accept it as normal. You know, a certain degree of worry, anxiety is normal. It is not. the mind of impatience. I mean, you know, we are a quick fix, get it done, you know, get it now, you know, we are impatient. We don't like waiting in line. We don't like being caught in traffic. We don't have to deal with people we don't want to deal with. We don't want to have to deal with situations that we don't want to think we deserve to be, you know, we are impatient. It's an energy. People, places, and things. Individuality. You know, we are raised to put ourselves first, to think of ourselves. I know best, I can do it myself. My needs first, your needs second. I mean, this is very cultural. Our individuality, our separateness, our selfhood isn't just problematic. It is something that we often enshrine and it's okay to live by. And I think many of us don't realize how strong that is in our culture. We are not a culture of interdependence. We are not a culture that is raised with a sense of the well-being of all is more important than the well-being of the individual. We are a culture that says, you know, you go out and get, you know, you go out and get it. Be number one, right? I'm just quickly through them. Another thing I think is one of our hindrances that I talked about is entitlement. I think we have a deep belief that things should go our way. You know, that we should have good parents and we should have had a good childhood and you know, everything should have gone our way. I should have a good job. I mean, it's not that we can't reflect on these things, but I think entitlement means we think we deserve it. We think we think we're entitled to be understood. Which is different than, you know, understanding that that may not be the case. If we feel entitlement, when we don't get where we're entitled, we get angry, we get hurt, we get disappointed, we get sad. So I think entitlement's a big thing. And again, this comes up a lot, you know, the mind that we don't trust. And I think a number of you talked about trust. Trust in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, trust in the teacher. Trusting one's, you know, and a lot of us, our relationships are have characterized by mistrust. Part of that's our own individuality, you know. I know best. Yeah, but what does that mean? I know best. What is this I that knows best? Your I thoughts know best. I can figure it out myself. So this often gets in the way, this mistrust, this over-reliance on the self, this over-reliance on my intellect, you know, I, me, I know best, you know. In other areas it could be fine, but if you really wanna transform, the inner world is a different world. I mean, as you just heard from the people involved, many people have been involved for years, and yet, we do not know our internal terrain that well. We don't have a lot of objectivity. We can't even name an affliction as an affliction. We can't even name a hindrance as a hindrance. We're not even sure that the I, me, mine is really the problem, my self-centeredness. We don't really believe that that my views may not be the right view. You know, we have a lot of distortions, my friends, and they get in the way. So we need to be able to elevate them and see them as hindrances. And the other thing I think you heard people refer about, and I do talk about it a lot, is this whole idea of aspiration, vow, you know, commitment, vow. I quote Shantideva a lot, who says the only thing more powerful than our historical conditioning. What is your historical conditioning? Your mind. Your thoughts, your feelings, your perceptions, the whole way you've constructed the world, the way you interpret the world, your filters. This is your historical conditioning. You weren't born with this stuff. Causes and conditions have created this. The quickest way through is to give yourself something else to energize you rather than your historical conditioning, your historical needs, your historical wants, your, you know, all this stuff. And that is an aspiration that turns into a commitment, that turns into a vow, because that can offset all the hindrances. The hindrance arrives, but you remind yourself of your vow. You remind yourself of your aspiration. If that is an ongoing part of your consciousness, it will power through. It will remind you, no, this is not what I want to be cultivating. This is not the way I want to be speaking. This is not, because this is not my, this is not what I've committed myself to in this lifetime. How I want to be, how I want to think, how I want to speak, how I want to show up. You know, what I want to be thinking about. You know, it's like, why am I thinking this? Is this bringing me closer to my fulfilling my aspiration? Does this have anything to do with it? Or am I just living from my historical conditioning, endlessly, you know, ruminating, you know, walking around the room in my conditioning, going over, you know, always, it's like we're in a room, you know, and it's all our stuff. And all we do all day is just walk around in our room, pick up this one, put it down, pick up another one, put it down. And we think that we're kind of acting freely, but we're always in our room. And we're always seeing and dealing with what's been constructed by our conditioning in our room. How do we get out of it? Aspiration for something different. That turns into commitment, that turns into vow, that becomes part of our life. So aspiration, vow, and this other piece I think that was very powerful for people was strategy, which ties to aspiration. And again, it comes from, I think, what you heard a number of people said, and a number of them who've been at Dharma for a while, is we realize we don't really have a personal ownership of the practice. We don't even have, we talked in the retreat, we don't even have a personal ownership of our mind. It is not clear to many of us that there's only one person responsible for my state of mind, it's me. There's nobody else. I mean, many people admitted at the retreat, they've lived their whole life with nobody in charge. Their mind, their act, it's gone wherever it goes, which means it always goes in the way of historical conditioning. We need to befriend ourselves. We need to become our ally. We need to take our aspiration, commitment, vow, and we have to actualize it through a strategy, and there has to be somebody home who's in charge of doing that. Who's in charge? You know, is there somebody, you know, in life, you know, we talk about, you know, who's dedicated to this, you know, in business or work, you know, who's in charge of this? There's got to be somebody in charge of this. I mean, in our community, we have, you know, five or six different areas, and we have leaders in each area. You know, you're in charge of this. Doesn't mean you run everything, but you're overseeing that area. You're watching it. I ask all of us, who's in charge of your transformation? Who have you given that to 24/7? And if you go, well, there's really no one. I mean, every now and then I think about it. I do meditate every morning. Well, we have to wonder, why is it that we get so scattered? That we often find ourselves chasing our tail year after year. It's not because we aren't good people. And it's not because we don't want to change. We do. but we are missing the technology of change. And one of the things I said to people in the retreat was, you know, the Buddha, after his great enlightenment, after his profound understanding of the nature of reality and the freedom inherent in human beings, in the human mind, he didn't just rest in that. He decided to go out and share it. But to share it, he had to use words. He had to take his enlightenment, his experience. He had to take his experience that he'd learned from his observation of life. He had to take it and operationalize it into a strategy that he could share with people. You know, that became known as the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the Six Paramitas. That was his strategy that he shared with humanity. And here we are, you know, 2,600 years plus later. We need to take his strategy, the Buddha strategy, and own it. And so I asked everybody in the retreat, and I could ask everybody on this, listening to this talk, you know, do you have your strategy for transformation? Do you have your strategy for fulfilling how you're going to fulfill your aspiration? And have you written it out? Is it clear? Clear in your mind? And is there somebody in charge of you know, putting it into practice? It's funny, when I used to be involved in organizational change, you know, people would have these great meetings and everybody would get together and decide, oh yeah, we got to change this, we got to change that, you know, be wonderful ideas, right? Okay, you do this, you do that. Okay, we're all going to do it. Never happens. And one of the reasons it doesn't happen, because there's nobody in charge of making it happen. There's nobody overseeing the process, troubleshooting the process, holding people accountable, right? Then it happens. And yet, we know that organizationally, but to the organization of our mind, you know, we're so loosey-goosey. The Buddha's way is a strategy for transformation, for awakening, for the end of suffering. We need to take that and we need to operationalize it in our own lives. And we can all do it. It's not that hard, but it takes reflection. It takes the willingness to stop, to pause in life, and to ask the type of questions you've been hearing, we've been asking over the course of these days. And again, you know, my hope is this was sort of an experiment for me to work with people in this way. Based on when we did our closing circle, it all seemed to be very positive. People seemed to get a lot of benefit from it. I think you heard that in the people today, and we will find ways to bring it into our paths, to elevate, you know, this thing. Hear the teaching, reflect the teaching, contemplate the teaching. Deeply, then practice. We have been lax, and I blame myself, so forgive me. So good, we will stop now. Ending our Dharma talk for today, for those who are on retreat, even though we had our closing circle, this is the formal ending of retreat. I really, again, want to express my deep gratitude to everybody who came on retreat. There was a lot of sincerity. People were good, motivated, shared a lot of goodness, very supportive of each other. You know, retreat is, you know, we're lay people. We have active lives. Therefore, retreat is even more important that we need, because most of us find it hard to pause and stop. So retreat forces us to step out of our roles, our responsibilities, to step back and to spend some concentrated time one day, 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, 10 days, 30 days, whatever, to really, you know, give this inner cultivation, this inner looking, you know, the time that it really needs if we're serious about wanting to transform. So with that, I again bow to everybody who was on retreat. I bow to everybody who is on listening to this talk. And David, please invite the bell. And are there any announcements?